You know, Kyle's got some tequila. It's all good. You know, it's Saturday. So let's have fun. Let's have a great pod. Any questions before we get started?
No, sounds good. I should get some wine.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Learn Videography, a podcast dedicated to mastering the art and business of becoming a full-time videographer. Presented by Industry Jump. Great. Hosted by director Kyle Loftus and producer JJ Englert. Let's go.
Welcome back to Learn Videography, your podcast to learn everything you need to know about becoming a full-time videographer. As always, I'm your host, JJ, and my co-host, Kyle Loftus. And today we have another special guest in the podcast, Nick Girard. He is a director, executive producer, production company owner in Austin, Texas, specializing in docu-style storytelling, anything that has some epic sauce to it, Nick's behind it. So super excited to bring Nick on the podcast today. We're going to be talking about how he chose his niche, how he's growing his production company, what he thinks about the digital nomad lifestyle, and now how he is pitching TV shows and developing those as well as taking that next step. So, Nick, thanks so much for joining us on the pod today.
Thanks for having me. Super, super excited. Long time listener, first time guest.
Hey, oh, yeah. I love it.
Love it.
I love it.
That's awesome, man.
Hey, right before we get started in the pod with the first question for Nick, I just want to shout out our 5-star reviews for this last week. We have BeWise Media, TS Music, and Slater Visuals. All 3 5-star reviews this last week. Really appreciate y'all coming in for us and supporting the podcast. Let's over on go. Apple Podcasts. So thank you for that, guys. Really appreciate y'all. Anyways, Nick, dude, you're awesome. Thank you for joining us. Why did you get started as a creator, and when was that?
Oh, man. I mean, my origin story is I was in fifth grade, and my dad had a VHS camera, which I actually have a tattoo of it on my arm.
Oh, yeah. Let's go.
It's a Zenith camera, and it's those big tapes, the VHS tapes.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was like, yeah, I have this camera, and we made a short film, and we did like a... we were making a movie about my dog and like someone breaking into our house and the intruder and the dog was going to save the day. And my dad was like, you want to see something cool? And he had it on a tripod and he hit record. And then he was like, okay. And my dog was in the shot and the, you know, the burglar was in the shot. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm going to make the burglar disappear from the shot with the dog just looking at the burglar. So I was like, you're full of shit. I'm like a little 12-year-old. I'm like, there's no way you can do that.
Yeah.
So he does like he stops the camera. He stops recording. It's on sticks, removes the burglar from the shot. The dog's still there, hits record, plays it back for me. My little 12-year-old mind explodes and because he disappears. And, I was sold. That was like the beginning of it for me. I was like, this is magic. You can make magic with movies. And I started making shitty short films, as I call them, in high school and middle school, and just like about the dumbest stuff, and making skate films with all my friends, and got super into that skate culture. And that was like, I was the guy. I was the film guy. You know, yep, I was filming.
I know that.
I wasn't that good at skateboarding, but I was good at filming, and I learned how to edit. And by then, we were upgraded to the mini DVs. Not the VHS, fish eyes, you know, the super wide lens. And yeah, that was,
that had to be at, what, like 480, like standard depth at that point, you know, like
probably.
Yeah,
it wasn't good. It's, we still have that film. It's called the Shunners film. That was the name of our crew, the Shunners.
There you go.
Yeah. We battled the other skate crews in town, and yeah, it was super fun.
Dangerous.
Sound hard. Sure.
Trying to emulate Jackass, you know. But, yeah. So that was like got me into it. And then I went to college and kind of kept going down that pathway of, you know, just learning about filmmaking and videography and photography.
So
and
how old exactly were you in fifth grade? So that would be like, 12.
So let's see. I was in sixth grade. Sorry. So I misspoke. I was in sixth grade. So I was 12. Yeah. I was 12 years old.
And wow. How old are you now, if you don't mind me asking?
I'm 36.
Damn.
Okay. Yeah, because it's just a very, very similar origin story to me. You know, like very, very, very similar. I think I first picked up a camera around 12 or 13. It was my dad's Sony XD, or Sony H6 Handycam. And same thing, started making like stupid little short films, Jackass stunt videos, all that stuff, man. So I really resonate with that. So what, like, where was the big transition point for you? Like, you know, where you went from, like, I guess, making little short films, and like, when did you first see it as a career? When did you start, when did that flip switch and you really wanted to start pursuing it in a career path?
I guess so. That is a little weird for me, and maybe it'll apply. And maybe people, younger people, might be able to sort of find themselves in this moment. You know, my dad was a was a banker, so he worked at like U.S. Bank. He's, you know, so he's a financial guy, corporate. You know, and like, he's a great dude. Like, he's the guy who got me into filmmaking, hence the tattoo story, right? That's sort of dedicated to him and that craft that I got into. But he wanted, you know, he was like, you should get a job, like a good job, a secure job, and like a corporate job. You know, so. He wanted me to go to school and do that. And I was like, I want to make films. And I looked into like film school, and like, this is, you know, a while ago, 2004-ish. Mm-hmm. And so like, you read about film school at that point, and it's like, oh, this is a pretty tumultuous career track. It's not necessarily a safe bet. So
this is before social media and everything, really. To give everyone else context, you know, there's this is film lane, and that's kind of it.
So it was a risky proposition to go to film school, to then go try to go, you know, trudge through the muck in the film industry to make a career where I could make money and have a living, right? So that was something that was I was aware of, and you know, my parents pushed me to consider something else. And what we settled on was broadcasting. So I went to school for broadcasting, and that covered television, which is a little bit, in that time period, a little bit more of a stable track, I think. And also like journalism and stuff like that, photography, photo J. So I got a degree in that at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, and, you know, studied like communication and all that good stuff. And coming out of that degree, I then was like, I got to try to get a job. I leveraged a connection with my friend Ian, who I went to high school with. He went to college with me. He studied journalism, and his aunt was like a VP at VH1, which back in the day, VH1 was like big shit. It was like, it was like MTV. It was like one of these cool companies to work at. So she was there, leveraged that connection, got interviews at VH1 with executives, and got on a clip show, like a TV show, and worked on a TV show as a production assistant in New York City, and moved to New York City and started working in the industry in a very specific niche. And that's kind of when I was like, okay, like I started it. I didn't go down that track, but that's where I started, was like working for Viacom. You know, they own Comedy Central, all these, you know, huge company. And then I moonlighted as an assistant editor to make some more money, because I was getting paid shit living in New York City, just living in the hood.
Scraping by.
Yeah. So I did that for a year. Didn't quite love it. Had an opportunity to pivot and go on the Warp Tour. I'm just constantly be dating myself on this.
It's all good.
But the Warp Tour used to be like this epic music festival to travel around the country.
Yeah.
And I had a chance to go on the Warp Tour as a guerrilla marketer. So I was working for a company called Truth, which is the biggest national nonprofit that educates people about tobacco and tobacco use. And they were a sponsor on the Warped Tour. So I got to go on the Warped Tour and travel on a tour bus, like a fucking rock star. Literally, like I was doing the same thing as they were. Same, like we had a tour bus, like we had, it was so sick. And then we got to like go share that message with people. And I was on the microphone. I was like an MC. And I was giving out free gear and doing all this stuff. And then I started shooting stuff on the side and just pushing it to like the marketing team and saying, hey, like I can do this. I did that for 2 years, and like slowly they were like started to use my content. And this is like kind of social media early days. They were using it on their Instagram, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't getting paid for that, but I was getting paid to like be a marketer. And then after 2 years of that, I got a call from their agency, which was Arnold Worldwide, which is like a big agency in terms of advertising agencies. They do big campaigns for big, like huge brands. And they're like, do you want to come film for Truth at South by Southwest, not go as a marketer, come to be our like cinematographer. And that was like my first like, oh, I'm going to work for myself. I'm going to freelance as a filmmaker, a videographer. Cause they were going to pay me like $500 a day. And I was like, dude, this is sick. Like, at that point in my life, I was like, I was making like $600 a week at VH1. And I was all of a sudden going to make $500 a day as a cinematographer. And I was like, this is what I need to do.
Yeah. You know? Kyle, guess what?
What's up?
Dude, we got a new season-long sponsor, and you won't believe who it is.
I think I might have an idea.
Riverside FM, the same platform that we're using to record this podcast right now. We got them on as a season-long sponsor. We were using the platform before they're a sponsor, and we're stoked to have them on this show as our sponsor. They're the leading podcast, video, and audio platform. Top podcast hosts like Gary Vee, Guy Raj, and so many others use Riverside as well. You can edit your videos within Riverside. You can do small little snackable clips. You can auto-create transcriptions with Riverside and so much more. So if you're looking to get into podcasting in the new year, go over to riverside.fm, check them out, and you won't regret it. See ya. Now let's get back to the episode. So you went on Warped Tour. These are like banging MTV days, right? Like this is like when, you know, you're hot, you're on MTV, and you go to South by Southwest and you're filming at South By and you're making $500 a day, were you saying?
Yeah.
Damn. And how long after college was this? Was this like 2 or 3 years?
So see, I graduated, I did a year in New York City at VH1. And so when I was there, I was, I guess to give you some reference, I made like, I think I made $650 a week as a PA. And then I was moonlighting on the weekends as an assistant editor and loader, mm-hmm. which I was like loading beta tapes, like into the Avid editing system and like spinning knobs and shit, some old school shit. Yeah. But I was making, I would put myself into overtime. So I would get time and a half at $25. So time and a half would be $37.50. So I'd be making like $37.50 an hour doing this. So that was great, but it was a lot of work. I worked like 60, 70 hours a week for like a year. And I was like, I just can't do this anymore. And then I did the Warped Tour as a marketer. I got paid a G a week. So I was like, this is sick. I'm getting more money. It's more fun. Mm-hmm. And then I got that opportunity to start filming and I was getting $500 a day. And then all of a sudden it was like, I had a 7D, Canon 7D. That was like my little baby. Yeah. And so I was filming with that and I was charging $500 a day to film and edit and stuff. And I was just like, I'm going to try to figure this out now. What was your question again?
So you, like at that point, you were just straight up videographer, like solo, run and gun, putting your own kind of trailers, clips together by yourself?
Yeah. So basically at that point, I had my tour manager on the tour when I was a marketer. Mm-hmm. He worked for himself. So I kind of went to him and was like, hey, how do I do this? Like it was a mm-hmm. different industry, but how do you navigate the business side of this? And he helped me put together a pitch mm-hmm. to pitch Truth and say, hey, basically kind of like, give me a retainer, essentially, like without calling it a retainer, give me a retainer. And so mm-hmm. I put together this pitch and was like, I'll do your social media. I'll do all this stuff. And the pitch was for like, $95,000. And I was like, yeah, I will do all this for the year. And then that'll be my job. And they were like, we'll take half of it. And I was like, cool. I can live on 50 grand. Like sick. You know? I was like, hell yeah. Like, so I did that and, they said yes. And then all of a sudden I was just like, they're like out, like I was freelancing with them, but I was kind of like their in-house videographer in a way mm-hmm. but they would just fly me out to all these events around the country to film stuff for their social. And that, mm-hmm. that gave me an opportunity to make enough money to do that for my career. And then also like, I was kind of young and I wasn't super disciplined at that time. So I just spent the rest of my time just living and enjoying my life, which I don't regret at all. It was very fun. I kind of just was like, cool, I'm going to get, you know, I have a salary essentially. And then the next year they renewed it and they renewed it and renewed it. And basically that was kind of like the runway I needed to build out some portfolio, to work out the kinks of running your own business. And, after like, I think 4 years, I think internally their ROI on it was not great. So they were like, without having that conversation, they just like kind of were like, we're gonna like not do this anymore.
Yeah.
And that then forced me to try to figure out new clients and diversify my portfolio of clients and really learn how to figure out how to make money other ways. And like along the way, like, you know, you're grinding. Like I was painting houses, you know, I was doing other stuff to make enough money. I was living with my parents for the first like 4 years, just like coming and going, like traveling around the country. Great. It was super sick and it was fun. Mm-hmm. But I was doing everything I needed to keep my career on that track in hopes of getting it to a more sustainable point eventually. You know, so it's being scrappy in the beginning was super important to get it off the ground.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. What was that like when you had to adapt? You know, when you kind of lost that big retainer client, what was that like adjusting, and how are you able to kind of navigate that and acquire new clientele? Because, you know, I think that's something, unfortunately, a lot of us had to face, you know, myself included. You know, I abruptly lost essentially a $35,000 retainer because they got acquired. And I know other people, you know, I'm sure plenty of our listeners have unfortunately lost clients due to COVID and other measures. So we'd love to hear, you know, how are you able to adapt to that scenario and acquire new clients and, you know, better position yourself after having, I guess, a negative thing like that happen?
So I had that downturn in what was essentially my entire salary, right? Mm-hmm. So that kind of just went away. And at that moment, I had also moved out of my parents' house into a small town in New England called Portsmouth, New Hampshire. It's like north of Boston. And that's where my now wife was from. And I was dating her, Chelsea. And I was like, it was either I was going to break up with her or I was going to move there, right? So mm-hmm. that was the choice. And I was like, I'll move there. Fuck it. If I have to, I'll become a real estate agent or like, what, you know, what? I'll do anything for love, you know? Yeah. So like, I kind of went there with that mentality. And then I lost like I think I was there for a year or something. And I kind of lost that like consistency of income with my main client. And I was just like, shit, like, what do I do? So I started kind of like paying attention to what in the market, in that little regional market, who was spending money on video, like mm-hmm. who's spending money on video stuff. And then it's like, okay, there's some agencies here that are doing work. Let's connect with them mm-hmm. and look at their clients. Who are they working with? Okay. They're working with banks. They're working with hospitals, and they're working with any like large corporation that happens to be based there, right? Mm-hmm. So car dealerships, that's another one, right? I didn't want to do wedding stuff. I had done like one or two, wasn't interested, knew it was an avenue, didn't mm-hmm. want to do that. So I think that's a great avenue if you're into it, awesome. If you need to do it, do it. I think it's a great way to make money and like get your feet off the ground. But there's another option if you're going regional. And I think that's like working with the people that have the money in the market that spend money on video. And to me, that was hospitals, banks, car dealerships, and any like large company that's nearby. So in Portsmouth, those large companies, there's like Bauer, the hockey company, mm-hmm. Timberland's based there. Mm-hmm. 6 Hour, the firearm company, is based there. Planet Fitness is based there. So there's some like huge companies there, right? Mm-hmm. So I started trying to make the connections with the agencies that work with these companies and just sort of just like wine and dine, essentially, like meet the people who are going to hire me to do this work and show them the work that I've done for a national brand already. Like, this is a mm-hmm. big brand. People know this brand, and say like, hey, I'm here. I can do stuff for you. And sort of like doing that networking thing. And I was able to do that. And it just kind of worked out, you know. I think the timing of it worked out well enough where, you know, I had connections at those agencies as I was doing the truth stuff, and sort of like they crossed over where I was like, okay, truth stuff went down, and now I'm doing a video for like a cat litter company because their agency is based here. You know, just like, it just, and then I was just kind of doing like a bunch of I don't want to say random shit, but kind of random shit, you know, like not really like in a niche of like what I was doing. It's just like random stuff that like there's budgets, right?
Sure.
I'm sure we've all had those days and months, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think especially when you're starting out too, or, you know, when you do have to transition or adapt, that's kind of a big part of it, you know, is kind of keeping your head above water. And as you mentioned, you know, if you're going to make that conscientious decision to mark out other or certain aspects of the market, be that weddings, then, you know, you might have to accept some other aspects of the market that you might not necessarily want to accept, be that some of the more rugged jobs. But yeah, continue.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's basically the answer, is like finding the businesses that spend the right amount of money in your market on video content and getting them to hire you. Like, that's the short of it. Like, you know, that's what I had to do. And then as time goes by, you get better at your craft. And like, my connection with Truth didn't go away. Like, it was like a year. And then a year later, they start calling me for random jobs. Right. Mm-hmm. So I don't have this retainer with them, but they still want to work with me. They still like me. I still do good work. And that relationship has continued to the point where there was like this lull for like maybe a year and a half or two, maybe. And then it came back, and then it was consistent. And then it's like, you know, I have two jobs pending with them in March and April right now. I did projects with them during the pandemic that like saved my ass, you know, like they've been there since day one. And it was just a moment where they were like, oh, this isn't working for us. We got to figure out how to work with you where it works for us. It wasn't a matter of like, oh, we don't want to work with you. It's just like, it's got to work for both parties. Right. And what we were doing wasn't right.
Sure. Yeah. When did you like start honing in on your niche, and like, you know, like what was that process for you? Cause you know, you're taking everything you can get, but like, when was that time where you started to actually really go in this one direction, you know, and kind of stay in there or find out what you really love and want to start building in that direction?
I think, so like thinking about the niche, I had found success in the local market in New Hampshire and was able to start securing some projects that were like, you know, enough money to like sustain myself. And then I like got an office space and I had someone there with me. His name's Lucas. He's the man. And we sort of had this rad space. We built this out, and it was like, It was awesome. And in doing that, we just had a lot of conversations about what could be, you know, for the business and aspirations for that. And I think in those conversations, it was like, well, we got to like focus on niching down. Right. Mm-hmm. And, was like just making a list of like, what do we like to do with our like hobbies and life, and like, what do we enjoy? And then it was like, okay, do those markets have a need for what we do? And if they do they have enough money to pay us the amount of money we need to run this business? Mm-hmm. And then it's tough to like, you know, I want to make car commercials. They want to see a car commercial. So it's like, you kind of have to do some spec stuff, I guess, or you have to sort of do some passion projects in that category. Or something like that's like close enough. Right. So we started doing that. Lucas and myself and one of my, not a business partner, but like I do tons of projects with him. His name's Chris Roller. The three of us went to Iceland and made a short, film about surfing in Iceland. And I think that like that's sort of like that kind of like is in that outdoor space. So my niche is, you know, documentary style and like adventurous outdoor brands, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, it's not super broad, but it's broad enough to cover a lot of brands. So like doing that was sort of in that category. We do that and we start connecting. Like I connected with Nemo Equipment, which does camping gear and stuff like that. They saw that this was like 7 years ago, and they're like, this is great. And, you know, sort of that seed starting to be planted. I did my first big project with them this past summer. So like, it was like a long time coming from like planting that seed and working on that relationship. But just like, you know, passion projects that align with that niche, and then just, you know, trying to connect with the people at those companies that have enough money to pay for your services. I think that was really the biggest, that was like the start of that process. And, you know, I think it's ongoing, the niching part of it. Cause it's like, we have the outdoor industry, adventurous outdoor industry, doc style stuff, right? And that like has a lot of lifestyle stuff to it. But at the same time, Truth being a like social nonprofit awareness campaign doesn't fall into that, but their willingness to like push and sort of be on the edge of the stuff that they make and be edgy kind of can align in a style wise way.
Yeah.
So you've been able to create a lot of relationships throughout this time. How are you networking? Like, how are you going out and meeting these people, developing these relationships? And also, you're keeping these relationships throughout many years. Like, are you, you know, proactively, you know, like maintaining those relationships? What does that look like for you?
And are you getting, like, how much of it is you getting involved in the community as well? I'm curious, you know, how much of it is not just building business relationships and maintaining those, but getting like personally involved in that community? Because I, you know, I think I've found personally a lot of success in that, like actually getting involved in the community, or be that the industry that that's kind of attached to what I might have an interest in doing more projects in.
Okay. So how do I maintain or develop the relationships? Yeah. Is that the first question? And then can you remind me of the second one? Okay.
Yeah.
We hit you with the 1-2 there.
Cause I was about to answer yours. I'm going to forget one of them.
All good.
So, okay. So the first question was about maintaining relationships or like making them.
Yeah. Procuring them. Like, it seems like you have a lot of relationships and you've kept them throughout many, many years. Right.
Yeah.
So one, how did you make those relationships? And two, how do you actively keep those relationships alive and healthy?
For building relationships with new clients, I think that that kind of takes a handful of different forms. Sometimes that's like referrals in your network, like word of mouth. I think that's like a good way. And I've definitely done that. It's pretty standard. There is also, you know, social media is something that you can use. To, you know, like if you follow the people that work in the market, if you find the right person, the person who's going to hire you, right? You got to figure that out first. Like, who is the person at the company that's going to hire you?
You need to know that one.
Yeah. So like that's step one, right? So I work a lot with direct to marketing departments at, businesses. So I know that the title of the individual that I need to work with is going to be like one of these five things, right? So then if I figure out what that is, then I can find out who they are on LinkedIn, and then I can find out who they are on Instagram, and then I can follow them. And if they happen to look at my work and like it, they might reach out, or I might reach out to them, or I might just engage with them on the platform and use like their photos or comment on their photos. And that's like one way to get your foot in the door. Obviously, it's not going to work that often, but it can work. You know, like I'm currently doing that with someone at the North Face that, you know, I followed her, I don't know, 2 months ago, and I just engaged with her post, and she messaged me the other day and was like, "Hey, did you go to this school?" And I was like, "No, but what's up?"
So, y'all need some help.
So I, you know, like started a conversation there, and you know, kind of at this point we're trying to set a time to like have a video chat, and she likes my work, and it's like, great, that's like a very normal organic way to connect with someone. And then another thing that I want to start doing is going to conferences that are targeted in my category. So there's a big outdoor conference in Denver. I was going to go last year, but I thought I had COVID, so I couldn't go, and blah, you know, fucking all that stuff. So, yeah. I'll try to go this year to that. So that's sort of like, and just cold emailing. Like, I mean, it's obviously it's, you know, 1 in 100 or something, but like the origin story of working with Nemo goes back to like 80 emails that Lucas and I sent in 8 years ago, just cold emails to all these companies. One of the agencies got back to us. They liked us and they connected us with Polar Tech, which makes like fleece. Polar Tech, they make like garments. And the guy who is the marketing person there, was his name's Darren. He was like, hey, let's do something together. We did something with Polar Tech. You know, 6 years later, I'm moving back to New England to you know, I was in Oregon for a while, moved back to New England. I messaged Darren, who I've stayed in touch with. And I'm like, hey, man, I'm coming back. Like, what are you doing? Like, how's Polar Tech? And he's like, oh, I don't work there. I work at Nemo. And I was like, oh, I've been trying to work with Nemo for 7 years. And he's like, well, I have a project. And I was like, sick. So then we did the project together, you know? So it's like, awesome. That came from a cold email. And it was just like, you know, just keeping in touch and just doing good work. Like that project we did, you know, he obviously thought it was good work and, you know, continuing to do good work and sharing that with people. And then another maintaining thing is like client gifts, which I think I try to get super creative with those. And not necessarily like I've gotten like a little postcard from agencies being like happy holidays and like that's fine, but that's not going to get you on the radar. So I guess there's so with Truth, right? So I had the lull and I sent out these mugs, a coffee mug, and Lucas and I painted the top half with chalkboard paint. And we got some like local cocoa mix and we sent them these mugs and we wrote messages on them. And we were like, you know, sent them these cool custom mugs that you can write on with a like chalk. And we sent them to all of our clients and Truth had sort of like gone quiet, but I'm still going to send them these things because, you know, I'm friends with all these people too, you know? So it's like, here you go. Cool gift. They all like it. You know, I think 6 months later, I got a message being like, hey, do you guys want to produce this 30-second spot? We're doing a collab with Vans Shoes and we need an in-store ad that's going to run in like Zoomies across the country and all over the country in shoe stores. Ooh. And it's going to be an ad for them. And it's a collab. And I was like, yes. And then I was like, asked Wendy, who's the person at the time who connected with me. And I was like, why did you call me? You know, and she was like, oh, I was actually like sitting at my desk and I was like, had this brief in front of me and I needed something, a production company to do this. And I saw your mug my like desk. And I was like, oh, I should hit up Nick. And then she went to her boss and said, why don't we see if Nick wants to do this? And then reached out to me. So, you know, it's like
client gifts, bro.
Client gifts, getting creative with those. This is another one. Someone wants to steal this one. I got a USB, I guess it's not super relevant anymore, but I got USB bottles and it was like a little glass bottle and it had a cork in the top and it had a USB on it. And it was like a message in a bottle. And we put together this really fun, like recap of the year with Lucas and I just like, we filmed a ton of BTS and it was like, here's what we did this year. Like blah, 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 message in a bottle and sent it to people. And they had this really, and it said Fortland on it. We had custom stickers on the bottle. So you keep it on your desk. And like, so when I was in college, this kid, I was an RA. And I'm in my dorm, so I was an RA, and this kid loved me. Like, he didn't even live in my dorm, but he just was like, you're the coolest, man. And I was like, sick. His name was Sean. He was awesome. But when I graduated, he was like, I want to give you something. And he took this metal business card out of his wallet. And this business card was also a bottle opener. Nice. And he handed it to me, and he was like, I know you like this because, you know, I'd be at a party and whatever, you'd open beers with it. I was like, that's so cool. And so he gave me that metal business card and it was in my wallet for, what was that, 2007? He gave it to me in 2007. It was in my wallet until last summer.
Wow.
And that's when I went out and made Fortland custom bottle opener business cards. And I put that in my wallet. So then when I meet someone who needs to remember me, I can hand them that. And that shit might be in their wallet for the next 20 years.
Yeah. I mean, that's the coolest business card I've probably ever seen. You know,
not
so
cheap.
Sure. But, you know, like finding clients, getting clients is not cheap. You know, and those relationships are worth $1 million, you know, figurative speech. But it's hard to come by, you know, and to preserve those, to keep those, right. You know, it's hard. And so any touch point you can get, that's why we promote, like, you know, newsletters and promoting your recent work to your clients and stuff like that a lot, because just to get touch points back in front of them to help them remember, you know, you and the work that you do and show them all your latest stuff, that, you know, businesses, they're facing a million things, right? They're focused on making money, right? They're not focused on who's the hottest creator or whatever. Like, they come up with a brief and it's like, I need to find the best creator for this. And if you're top of mind, you're going to be having a better chance than folks that aren't, right? Simply put.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that there's, for me, the market that I push into is of a certain scale in the project budgets that I don't have a need to have a ton of clients. So for me to spend a little bit more money on premium things is easier. So like that the business card I described is, you know, it's a metal business card that's, you know, laser engraved and you can open a beer with it. They're like $11 each, right? So like if you were going to give that to hundreds of people, it would be expensive. I mean, maybe it is worth it. I don't know. But for me, I'm just like, I can kind of get away with having like 10 of those and just being like when I was going to go to Outdoor Research, I had a list of people. And if I met them, if I ran into them, they were getting one of these because I knew that was the person they would hire me at this company that has enough money to do the projects that fit into my business model. And that's worth it.
Yeah. And like you knowing those people and who those are is like step one, like you said earlier, like you need to know who those people are. Right. And the fact that you had that is tremendous research and preparation for those moments. And you had those prepared for those moments too.
It's all that time that you don't get paid for where you're just cruising on LinkedIn, looking for, there's a website called Rocket Reach and mm-hmm. you can find people's emails on there. And like just using tools like that help you, like you got to be a little detective. You know, you sleuth. Yeah. And so I think that's like, it's fun for me, you know, I like doing it. So it's kind of, I think that's helpful.
Yeah. Coming out of film school, there was like 5 commercial production companies in Orange County, California, where I was living. And I really wanted to go work at a commercial production company. And so I just went to each of the websites and just emailed all of the CEOs of those companies. And none of their emails were public, right? But I just made up the emails like andy@companyname.com, right? And then all the variations. And one of those hit. And 2 weeks later, I was on a BMW commercial with them as a security guard, right? Just proving my worth. And then I ended up producing a Europe show for them. 3.5 weeks, we did 8 countries skateboarding through Europe. And I produced the whole thing. And that all came from a cold email that I just made up their email addresses to try and connect with one of them, right? It's just like, you got to know what you want. You got to know how to find those people. And you need to go out there and hit it up as many of them as freaking possible, because not all are going to hit, but you're not going to hit any, you know, balls if you're not at the bay, you know, if you don't have a bat in your hand, for that bad analogy, but you know what I mean.
Hell yeah. No, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's so true.
What's up, guys? We're back at it with another sponsor, which is ShareGrid, the largest camera sharing community on planet Earth, where you can rent or buy cinema gear. Now, ShareGrid.com is perfect if you're trying to test out a camera before you buy it, or if you want to upgrade to a cinema camera for your next shoot to shoot that crispy 6K footage, 8K, 12K, find it all on ShareGrid.com. Or if you're looking to make some extra money, you can go to ShareGrid to rent your gear out or even to sell your gear on ShareGrid.com. It's a professional way of renting and buying gear, super safe and secure. They have insurance behind all of their transactions. So if you want to join the camera sharing community today, go to sharegrid.com. You won't regret it. Now let's get back into the episode.
Just kind of transitioning off of that a little bit, you know, when we're talking about working with a lot of kind of bigger brands and businesses, having these longer term relationships and more marketing budget to kind of fluff with, if you will, relate that back to kind of, you know, working with a team and building up, you know, your Fortland production company. What was that process like of, I guess, making that transition? You know, I think that's a hard transition for a lot of people to make as creators, going from that one man band to working with other people, knowing when is the right time, also knowing you're kind of, in a way, you're forking over part of the budget, which feels like you're losing money. Just talk about that process and, you know, finding the right people to work with, and, you know, choosing, you know, who's in charge of what that relationship looked like, and setting boundaries. Walk us through the works, please.
So for me, I really went, you know, I was freelancing as basically a solo filmmaker, right? In the beginning of my career, that was sort of my bread and butter. I was doing everything. And then I aspired to have a production company and like scale it up and have an office and have a team and employees and all that. And so I did that before I had a need to do that, which is not a great thing to do. And I got an office space. I found Lucas. I bought, you know, a cinema camera. I put the cart before the horse big time. And I did that for 3 years. And I was also still super, super particular about the kind of work that I wanted to do and didn't want to do in that moment where we're talking about the niching down. It was like, could we have doubled down on doing the regional moneymakers, being, you know, banks, hospitals, all those things, and scaled the business? Sure. Like, we definitely could have. But I was also not super interested in that in the long run. So there was this weird tension between trying to make enough money to support this production company I was already spending money on,
right,
and not wanting to do that work. Mm-hmm. And after it's 3 years,
like, even harder, right? It's just like, you're not making money and you're losing money. And it's like, what is this balance? Yeah. It's so tough.
Yeah. In after 3 years of doing that, I was able to recognize that approach wasn't time for that. And it wasn't what I wanted to do. So I had to have a hard conversation with Lucas and just be like, man, like, I don't think this is going to go the way that we wanted it to go. And I'm going to get rid of the office and we're going to sell the kegerator. And, you know, like,
that's a dark day,
dude. It was super sad because we had, you know, we had our little space and it was just so fun. And did that. And it was a fiscal thing too, because I was like looking at my books and being like, okay, I used to pay myself like $70,000 a year. And then all of a sudden I'm paying myself like $35,000 a year for 3 years. And then I was like, this just isn't going to work. Like, I don't want to do this, you know? So it was like, all right, cut your losses. That was fun. Let's get back to what we were doing and see where we can go from there. So that's what we did. I got rid of the office. You know, I scaled super far back. I'm back in my home office. Mm-hmm. And immediately I triple my salary, right? So I'm back to making as much money, more money than I was before, because I had built up new relationships.
Yeah.
And, you know, from there, you know, started to double down in that niche, started to, you know, Chris Roller was a huge factor in, he came, you know, he was making these crazy sorority videos at UNH, and like Lucas and other people in the community were like, dude, look at this kid. And I was like, we got to meet this guy. So we met Chris, and it was a funny story. I'm not going to go into it, but we, you know, we became buddies. And one day he hit me up and was like, hey, I need a producer for Timberland Pro Shoot. Do you know anyone? And I was like, bro, I'll do it. And we did that, and it was super small. And I helped him produce it. And then 4 years later, like, that relationship has been scaled with the two of us working on the projects together, but we scaled it a lot to kind of take over their brand campaigns for their lifestyle photography. And, you know, they're still doing their national TV commercials with the Martin agency and with a different production companies. But like, we have a big piece of the pie that is their content. And, you know, we love working with them and scaling that up. But still, I don't have an office, and I'm not getting an office. I'm just working from home, and I don't have employees, but I have a roster of subcontractors that I work with all the time, and I love working with them. And I just understand, like, I'm so thankful that I was able to go through that period of time where I thought that's what I wanted, to then realize that's not what I want. And what I want is to have this awesome team that I can plug and play depending on the project. And finding the clients that are like, they're cool with that. Like, they don't need to come to my office and be like, oh, this place is like so cool or whatever. It's not about that. And I think maybe COVID helped double down on that, where it's like, you can work from home and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, I have a team of subcontractors that, you know, some are local and we keep building it out, and some aren't. And like, I fly people in depending on the needs of the project. And if I can't find a reliable local person, I'll bring in someone, you know, who I trust. And that just kind of keeps growing. And I spend less time building that out. But I still, you know, when someone follows me on Instagram, not every time, but I'll look at their portfolio. And if I'm looking at, you know, their photos, I'm like, oh, this person seems like they're not in the game, but I like their style. I might hit them up, be like, hey, are you trying to like do lifestyle photography in the outdoor industry? And just sort of put the, you know, come shoot some BTS for me or whatever, and kind of see if they might be able to be someone who's on my team. Cause I'm not the photographer. I pull the team together, you know, I'll direct the video. I'm not the DP. Like I, you know, I'm able to do those things, and I do them sometimes, but for the bigger stuff, I'm the executive producer and, you know, directing the video content.
How much has self-awareness played a role in your whole journey? You know, you talk a lot about kind of, I don't know, you just seem very aware of what you're good at, what you excel at, / what you also enjoy. I'd love for you to just kind of talk about that a little bit more. You know, you mentioned things like, you know, choosing kind of to take on that role in producing and overseeing, rather than, you know, trying to produce and be the director and DP and operate the camera and you know, function out all these different roles. Just love to hear you kind of elaborate more on that, if you will.
The pathway to understanding what I was good at and what I wasn't good at and letting go of roles was a hard pathway to like navigate. It was very challenging. And I think that is probably going to be the case for a lot of people. I remember just being so offended early on when I would get notes on an edit from someone, and it's just like, you got to figure out how to like take criticism and understand that like, this isn't your passion project. You're getting paid for it. Right. So like, it's not about what you think is cool. It's about what works for the project and what works for the client. Right. So like, I think the same goes for those different roles where it's like, oh, I want to be the DP. I'm not the best DP. Like Chris is a good example. Chris Roller is a way better DP than me. And like, even like Alex Broadstock, like his roommate, I work with him too. And like, he's phenomenal DP, right? Like, they just have better eyes than me for making beautiful imagery, but I'm a better storyteller. And like, I can help identify characters better in terms of like the bigger picture, you know? So it's like, can we complement these roles and make a better project together? Hell yeah, we can. And if I try to do everything, it's not going to be as good as it can be. Right. And if they try to do everything, it's not going to be as good as it can be. And I, you know, that's sort of, I guess you got to check yourself and be like, you're not going to be the best at everything. And you might as well just double down on what you're good at. And if you, mm-hmm. if it's not like the sexy, cool thing, maybe it is. Maybe you're just in your head. You know, maybe it is the sexy, cool thing to be the producer and not the DP. I don't know. Like, it's, I, you know, like, or vice versa, right? So, like, it's just, like, not easy. Not easy. The answer is it's just not easy. It's really tough to, like, get to that point and just, but it's helpful once you get there because all of a sudden you're, you know, you're on cruise control on the highway instead of, like, stop and go traffic where you're trying to, like, figure out, like, what you're doing and you're like, this worked. No, it didn't. And like, you know, and now it's like, oh, like, I'm good at sales. I'm good at talking to clients. I'm good at, like, navigating a contract and, like, the people that I work with that aren't good at that but are good at everything else, it's a match made in heaven. You know, it's like we just can fill in the roles with each other and it just works really, really, really well. And if you don't want to embrace what you're good at, it's going to be a lot harder.
Yeah, I think, you know, like, that's the goal. But I think that also runs the risk of, like, you know, sometimes you get in the zone where, like, you're working with creators, right? And in this case, you're working with Chris and a couple others. And sometimes, like, they have designated roles and they just need someone to fill in along the way. And so you just keep filling in over and over. And then all of a sudden, you're a position that you didn't really set out to be because you filled in so many times and all those things, right? And it's kind of like how I kind of got lost in the music video world early on. Like, I didn't want to be a music video producer, but I just kept getting hit up for music videos. And I was just like, okay, okay. And then all of a sudden, 2 years in, all I've done is music videos. And I built a portfolio on something I didn't really want to do. And networks and contacts all around that, right? And so it's like, one thing is like, you need to be aware of, you know, the opportunities that you are saying yes to and the pack that you're running with in some sort of way. And like, does that all make sense? And in your case, it certainly does. But some situations doesn't, right? And you got to make sure that you're setting all of you up for success. And if you're not in a position where you want to be in, it's important for you to recognize, evaluate that, and then put yourself into a position that you want to be in for that long-term success.
Yeah, I feel you on that for sure, because I think that for me, when I started doing more producing, I wasn't very excited about it. And I didn't think I told myself going into it that I didn't like it. I don't want to do this. I don't want to be a producer. I'm a cinematographer. I'm a director, right? And like, I sort of like did it because, like you said, like I did it because that's what was showing up. But yeah. After a couple of years of it, it wasn't the same scenario for me where I was like, oh, I really hate this. I was like, I'm fucking good at this. Like, yeah. I like, do I get joy out of negotiating a sick deal with a client? Yeah, I do. Sick. So like, I mean, like, why fight it? Because I thought what I had to do was be a cool cinematographer. And there's not like, I'm just not that good at it. There's a lot of people way better at it. And I'm good at this.
Sure.
And I actually like it, you know? So it's just sort of like getting out of my own way to like, you know, the story you're telling yourself could be wrong, you know, and maybe give yourself an opportunity to tell yourself a different story about a different role and see how it feels. Just give it a try. What's the worst that's going to happen? You might like it and you might realize that maybe you're supposed to be a DP and not a producer, or a producer and not a DP, or an editor. You know, who knows? I fully respect what you're saying, because that also sucks if you're like pigeonholed. And in that case, you got to find other people who are doing the other stuff. Like, so if you're like, oh, I don't want to be a producer, I want to be a director, then you got to find a partner that complements you.
100%. So you're doing a lot of development work now. Can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, that development work, how you kind of created those relationships or created those opportunities in order to even put together development work for longer form stuff?
So I mentioned earlier on my friend Ian, who I, you know, his aunt worked at VH1, and that was a connection I had that got me my first job in TV. Ian, we went to high school together, we made short films together, we went to college together, he studied journalism, and he went down that track, you know, wrote for, you know, Wired, Rolling Stone, GQ, like just very large publications. He ended up writing a book and he got it published. It's in Barnes and Noble around the, you know, all over the place, you know, and like So he's done well as a journalist, and I've sort of had this other track of like production in commercial, and I'm always like hitting him up being like, yo, like we've been looking for a project to do together forever. You know, we've known each other forever. We've been looking for this project to do together. So I'm always throwing him ideas. And he actually had kind of a spinoff from his book that turned into a TV show. And it was like about magic. And he produced this magic show that was on True TV and sort of like got into that world of television via his journalism and his book. And that was, you know, from day one, if we go back to the beginning, it was like, I want to work in film. And like film, I would say, is like TV and movies and, you know, that sort of a thing. So that was sort of the original passion. So, you know, I talked to him about storytelling a lot. He's an amazing storyteller. I've learned tons about storytelling from him. And then that also includes identifying stories that happen to be in front of you. So one of my friends knew a guy, and this guy's story was fucking crazy. And I was like, let me talk to this guy. And I talked to this guy. He told me his story. This guy's a crazy character. And I'm always throwing ideas at Ian, being like, hey, what about this? What about this? What about this? And like this time I told him the log line for this story I did. And he was like, yeah, let me talk to this dude. And so we started talking to this guy. And Ian's connected. Like he has an agent at a very notable agency that does TV and film. And like he's in that world already. So I shared this idea with him. He liked it. He asked me, can I be part of this? Can we do this together? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. So we developed the idea more, flew down to Florida to film with this guy, filmed a sizzle, put it in front of Ian's agent. And she was like, this is something. So then we started, I didn't know how any of this shit worked. Like just the whole world of like TV and all that and like films, like I was like, I don't know how to do any of this. So that's the first step. Right. And then from there, you know, we pitched the idea to production companies. A production company wanted to do it with us. You know, we pitched it to a handful of different ones, and we sort of found a good match, and they signed a deal with us to develop the project further. And we've been working on that for the last, I think we signed that like late summer. So we've been working on it like 5 months now. And now, you know, we have finally get to the stage where we have the sizzle dialed and we have, you know, the story is still developing. So it, like it has historical, it's a retrospective, but it also has current stuff. So where the story is developing in a really like interesting way now. And the agents at the agency that represent all of us have pitched it to a bunch of different, you know, networks that you've heard of, like, you know, like you stream shit on streaming services, like those places. And we have meetings set up to like pitch this idea to multiple networks. And, you know, that's awesome. I think the first one is on Wednesday, you know, like a couple of days from now. And yeah, it's just sort of like a whole new experience, way different than what I've been doing in commercial work. But I think, I guess in like kind of to circle back to what we were talking about a second ago, like in commercial work, I've found myself EPing and directing a lot and having a lot of like help with the visual part, you know, doing a lot of stuff with Chris and stuff like that. In this partnership with Ian, it has a very beautiful harmony in that like Ian is a investigative journalist. Like he has that profile and he knows how to do that really well. So his storytelling is like amazing. But I've been working in production, doing commercial productions at different scale for a long time. I love documentaries. I DP'd a documentary, and so I have this visual language, and like the two of us have collaborated in that way to like sort of fill each other's roles in a different way than I have in my partnership with Chris. But it works really well where we just, there's harmony in like the positions we're playing, and with the stuff I see, he doesn't see, and vice versa.
For the sizzle, did you guys do that on your own dime?
We did.
Yeah.
And that was a we had a long conversation about it.
That takes a lot.
And ultimately, Ian was, he was just like, dude, this idea is just too good. This guy is too good of a character. It was just, so we, I think we spent
$2,500. But it still took us investment
I own the C200. There's a lot of costs that didn't happen because of the in-house gear I have, the skills I have. Like, I had Ian, who doesn't know how to do anything, being my grip, setting up the lights and just, so it was like, it was super scrappy. I think if you looked at the true value, it was probably in the editing time. Oh my God, dude, I spent so much time. And to be fair, the production partner did spend money helping us refine the edit with another editor. It's just a different world. And, that it's crazy, it's like if we're pitching as a doc series and if you get funded with a network, it's not, it's a lot of money to it's like, I don't have to push any of the buttons, we hire people who are way better at it than I am. So it's just kind of a cool brand new world that I'm going into, I guess.
What are your biggest learning curves with it? What have been some of the biggest or I guess most eye-opening things with this journey of, pitching and building out something for streaming TV series?
I think the amount of time that everything takes, it's just long. I started having conversations with our character December of last year. We filmed the sizzle in March of last year, and our first meeting with a network is basically a year after we filmed the sizzle. Yeah. And it's just so long. Everything takes so long. It's just surprising. It's that's definitely the biggest. And then it's also, oh man, it's such a long process to know now that it still might not happen. I'm hopeful. It's a good story. It's a good idea, I think. And obviously we've spent a lot of effort on it, but there's a chance it doesn't work out.
You're lucky you're lucky you got some development money to do this. So it's not just straight investment and you just doing it for a year, but in terms of development and as a producer, that's you have to juggle so many projects, active project, development projects, post projects, right? And got to always wear those hats, which is really difficult.
Yeah. But now there's also the opportunity that comes along with this, that I now have, this connection at this agency and essentially an agent to put other ideas in front of. So I can now say, hey, here's this new idea I have, and I've done that already. So I'm developing a second idea for another doc series I wouldn't have had that connection to make that opportunity come to life unless this had happened, it's such a weird gatekeeper situation. Mm-hmm. You'd like to think that the best ideas are always going to get made and get funded, but that's just not how it works. So I just feel super fortunate, I just feel very, very fortunate to have had the opportunity to get my foot in the door to at least be like, what about this idea? And most of those are not going to work. But just having the chance is fucking cool, man. I don't know.
As we work to wrap up here, Nick, any last words of wisdom for our videographers out there, our content creators, 2, 3, 4 years into the business, looking to grow, take that next step? You've been at this now for more than 20 years, and any kind of words of wisdom for all of them?
As he ponders, looking up at the moon.
No pressure, no pressure.
I think that sort of trying to be patient with yourself and with your clients and with your relationships and all that is really valuable. I think early on for me, there was a lot of moments where I was just so quick to take something personal or be super anxious about a deal coming through, or, you know, I just think being patient with yourself and with everyone involved is super useful. And then also just trying to have empathy with, like, you know, your clients and what the feedback they're giving you and all that stuff too, because yeah. It's easy to think about yourself and what you think is the right thing to do, but it's not just about you. It's about a lot of other people and a lot of other needs. And I, for me, at least in the beginning, it was just really easy for me to get offended about something, or really easy for me to be narrow minded about things and just not take a minute to be like, it's going to be okay. If this doesn't happen, I'll figure something else out. Or this note that I got isn't about me being a bad creator. It's just not fitting the needs of the project for the client, you know? So I think that's sort of a really hard thing to put into practice, but if you can do it earlier, you're going to have a lot more. Yeah, it's just going to be, I think, a lot less stressful.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Agree, man.
Yeah. Nick, thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to walk us through your journey, the ups and downs, and how you kind of have found your stride in your niche and now developing long form series. And, you know, hopefully, fingers crossed for this week, man. Hopefully the pitches go well. Hopefully we see a long form series out of you very soon. For our guests out there, you can follow Nick at Nick's Fort, NICKSFORT on Instagram, or you can learn more about his production company, fortlandproductions.com. You can learn more about us at JJ Englert and Kyle at Cal Visuals. You can follow our podcast at Learn Videography. Yeah. We'll be back next week with another podcast episode. Really appreciate y'all tuning in. Nick, thank you again for taking the time out of your day to drop knowledge for all of our listeners. Appreciate y'all.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for listening. I appreciate the time.
Hell yeah, man. Thanks for coming on.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you next week.
Later. Yeah.